Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello and welcome to Podcast Like It's 1999, the podcast where we talk about the films of 1999, surrounded by dead bodies here in 2022. I'm one of your hosts, Kenny Nybart.
And I'm Phil Iscove.
And with us again to talk more British cinema, our favorite Anglophile. Karen Hahn, so good to have you back.
So happy to be back on the show and also to talk about this movie, which, yeah, and we'll get into it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. This movie is it's interesting because, I mean, Karen and I have been, you know, we've been trying to get this on the books for a while, and I knew that this was a film that you were excited to talk about. But, you know, Guy Ritchie is a weird thing. Like, his career in and of itself is a strange thing. Like, as I was watching this yesterday, I looked at his filmography and I was kind of surprised how quickly he became a thing. Do you know what I mean? Like, obviously this movie is a big hit, sure, but then it does feel like Snatch, which I have not rewatched since it came out. I don't know if Snatch holds up. Maybe it does, maybe it doesn't, I don't know. But it does feel like he gets Sherlock Holmes pretty quickly. I mean, it's crazy.
How could you not give the director Swept Away $20 million.
I mean, that's a crazy thing in and of itself. I mean, obviously there's the Madonna of it all, but just like, you know, Lock, Stock comes out in 99, obviously, and 10 years later he's got Sherlock Holmes. That's a pretty quick, you know. Anyway,
yeah. He very quickly, and this was the time, this was the exact period when this could happen, he very quickly became a brand. Becoming a brand is a huge deal for Hollywood, who are, you know, really a bunch of boring people and don't want to do the work themselves. So if you can have a fully packaged product like Guy Ritchie, who has a brand and a voice and a specific style, marrying with Sherlock made a lot of sense. Now, full disclosure, never seen one of those movies. Don't really want to.
They're fun.
Yeah, I'm sure they're great for other people.
Kenny, have you seen his studio output, I guess, is the bigger question. Like,
I've never seen Man from Uncle, anything King Arthur, except Aladdin, for this and Snatch.
Oh wow.
I didn't even watch I've seen bits and pieces of Aladdin. I didn't even watch Swept Away for our Razzie draft.
I knew that wasn't going to be good on
there. I mean, the main reason I haven't watched the studio output is because those movies just don't really appeal to me.
I think The Man from U.N.C.L.E. quite honestly. It's a fun
movie. I've heard such good things about it that maybe I would give it a shot, but they don't really appeal to me. And part of that is because, like, I'm not super into this movie or Snatch.
Yeah, if you don't like this in particular, I do feel like it's very like if you're not on this wavelength, then you're just not on the wavelength because it is what it is. His style is his style.
By the way, I don't dislike this movie, but I might be totally wrong, and this is a very unfair thing to say having only seen a few movies by him. It feels like this is like the top of the top in terms of what he does, because I think there's so many elements of this that are excellent and some that are like so not excellent that I don't really want to sit through more of him. All right, that's it. I'll tell you specifics when we get to it.
So Karen, I'm mm-hmm. curious, you know, so did you see this film in 99? I'm assuming not.
No.
No, okay.
Yeah.
So this movie, it's interesting, Kenny, because did you see it in 99? Around then?
Yeah, definitely around there. You know, this is a must watch for a boy like me in college.
Well, and also just for because it was a real moment, right? Like, I think it's what's interesting about this movie, and I would argue Guy Ritchie, or what we sort of associate with Guy Ritchie, I guess, is kind of a British Tarantino.
I was gonna say the same thing, like that's very much feels like not in terms of like how well it's done or in tone, but it's like British Reservoir Dogs in the same sense of like impact for that director.
Yes,
British Reservoir Dogs with I mean, I do think it's British. I think he saw the first two Tarantino movies and said I could do something like that, because definitely British Reservoir Dogs, but also you know, like Reservoir Dogs very, very much is about those six guys, or really about four of them. This is so sprawling. You know, this is pulling together like three or four disparate elements. So that feels very Pulp Fiction-y. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's very, I mean, truthfully, I haven't seen this movie since it came out. And it is convoluted. Like it is, I was very confused. Part of it is the accents. I have to be honest, the accents are tough to discern, but it's like on top of. I did subtitles. I should have done subtitles.
It's a subtitle movie if there's ever been one.
I really should have. It's interesting because I feel like there is the Tarantino thing, and then this is going to seem maybe more harsh than it should, but there's the Boondock Saints of it all too.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Felt that too, buddy.
Right?
It's like the laddie energy. Where it's like, oh, we're lads, yes, you know.
Totally. Yeah. I think it's also because, you know, working in a video store. Sorry, go ahead, Kenny.
I think this is the photo negative of Boondock Saints.
No, for sure.
I think what this does well, Boondock Saints does horribly, and what this does horribly, Boondock Saints does well.
Yes.
Now,
yes.
I think this is a million times better than Boondock Saints, because Boondock Saints is so deeply deplorable at its, because Boondock Saints is so deeply deplorable at its core.
Yes, yes, yes.
But I mean,
this movie's playful and kind of cute about its murder.
Yeah, I mean, look, frankly, the last bit of this movie jumped it up like 15 points for me. Like this movie never stops having jokes.
Yeah.
So like, I'm super into that. Like it just never stops like being like, no, we're in this for the yucks. Like nothing else.
Yeah.
But
actually sort of on that note, to interrupt really briefly, I almost feel like Kenny, you would like Sherlock better than like the rest of Guy Ritchie's movies, because the one thing that I would say that differentiates those like franchise movies that he does from the like Guy Ritchie movies is that like someone is forcing him to have a little more direction, or like it's supposed to be more fun or broadly appealing than I think he has sort of lent with like later movies. Like thinking about Snatch and Revolver and Rock and Rolla, like he gets more and more into the Guy Ritchie brand in a way that I think like his bigger movies like don't. But anyway, that's my
I would go down that road a little bit.
Yeah. I can talk about it and why I love that last scene so much as we get to it. I'm just going to, you know, cut ahead to what I think is like so bad about this movie. It's horrible to look at. It's like,
it's so ugly. Yeah.
It's horrible to look at. And it is so poorly blocked and framed and colored. And it's this weird sepia throughout the whole thing
which was a choice he's talked about.
Of course it's
so
a
bizarre.
Yeah.
Wait, what has he said about it?
Well, just he talked about the monochromatic sort of the look of it was intentionally wanted it to feel sort of like weathered and old. And I think that he thought it was going to give it this, like, I don't know, this like classical vibe. Yes, like that it felt like,
it seemed to be reaching for the British crime dramas of the 70s and 80s, specifically, sure, Last Good Friday, right? Like it seemed to be, yes, like, I am doing for what my youth, what Tarantino did for his youth. And part of that is an aesthetic, but it's also to me like a lack of ambition when it comes to using the camera. And because of, and I think he does himself a disservice, because I do think every other element is great. I think there is style to this. I think there's a lot of, and the other part is, and this isn't his fault, this is the fault of the British monarchy, it's the whitest fucking movie. I know there are a couple of black characters, but these guys, and it's not even, I'm not saying that like there should be more diversity. I'm saying that like, yo, I can't tell these guys apart.
That was my thing too.
I am genuinely lost with, I'm genuinely
the four
lost
leads
with, yeah, which crew I'm with. I'm with at any given time.
Are there any Karen boys in this?
This is like top to bottom.
It's nothing but Karen's boys.
Yeah. I saw this movie and watched it because of like a couple of crushes that I had on some of the actors in the movie, and then it was just like the list got like longer and longer. Anyway,
I assumed by far, and I'm not saying this as a joke, by far the hottest guy in the movie is his name Bill the Baptist?
The heavy guy,
so hot.
Yeah.
He's like a 10 out of 10. I think he's like, I think he's got that Gandolfini thing where like,
charisma is making up for like,
he's nothing but like, he's got that Hoskins thing, you know?
Yeah.
He's got like that British Hoskins thing. He's hotter than Hoskins. He's got that Hoskins thing.
I do think
and then the other
like
guy
hairier,
is like,
though. Do you know what I mean? Does. He's like sweatier.
People seem to be into that. Like this, like isn't like this is the this is like this is the ideal male physique thing about Hoskins without a shirt.
Hoskins without a shirt is a hairy, hairy man.
Yeah, it's
it's something else. I do want to sort of I want to just piggyback on what you were saying, Candy, in terms of the style, because I do think that, and I don't want to keep saying like if you watched his future films, but I do think that he does get a handle on his visuals as he, quite frankly, gets a little bit more money. Mm-hmm. Like
almost,
I think the aesthetic
almost has to.
Right, exactly. Because like I do think that, and what I do remember about Snatch isn't much, but I do remember the Brad Pitt component, obviously, and the bare knuckle boxing component of it. And I did think that with a little bit more money and quite frankly, a below the line that can allow Guy Ritchie to make the movies look the way that he wants them to look. Like you, what I think you're sensing in this film, Kenny, and I agree with you, is a guy who has something in his head and is incapable of actually executing it. So like you're seeing the potential of visuals there that don't completely come together.
I think what it is the quote unquote potential of visuals, because I think every shot in this is a choice, you know. It's all well thought out. It's not as if he wasn't capable of it, but I think he was trying something so specific and so born out of this like British austerity, stagnant camera, BBC shit, where he didn't take everything that's interesting about the early Tarantino movies. Took some of it and then tried to marry it with something that's a little more not my style. You know what's interesting though, because another British director who has a kind of boring first film this year that we've done is Chris Nolan. Nolan, the following is kind of similar to this too, in that you're seeing a little baby version of what you're gonna get.
Yeah.
And And I think the limitations of the following are similar to the limitations of this movie, where, you know, what did he have, $30,000 or something? So it's a bit
more than that, actually. He had a budget of $1.4 million.
I'm talking about.
Oh, you're talking about Following?
Chris Nolan.
Following was nothing. Following was like in the five.
It was days.
Minuscule.
No, I know. Guy Ritchie got like Sting in this movie. I mean, like, he was a different guy at this you know, no, really. I mean, I read a little bit about it. He was a guy who like produced a really well beloved short.
Short, yeah.
And got some serious money, but it does, you know, it does have that same kind of, like, to me, Following is a similar, like, I'm gonna meld kind of the mind fucks of the 90s with some, you know, more British-esque stuff that I'm doing now. Memento doesn't feel like it's a British film at all.
I don't necessarily think that Nolan has that much British sensibilities necessarily in his films.
I know what you're saying,
but I do think that. So I
that's
mean,
just about it, money now.
So Karen, in terms of, like, you know, where this falls in kind of what's interesting about this, and it's sort of what Kenny's talking about, which is mm-hmm. that. You know, Guy Ritchie obviously has a big splashy entrance into cinema. He does a handful of sort of pseudo British kind of movies, and then eventually gets kind of co-opted by the Hollywood machine, and mm-hmm. that's where he is now. And then he made The Gentleman, which I've never seen.
It's all still bad. I mean, as far as I can tell, they're all still these like $200 million movie, but with like strong like British sensibilities. Right,
yeah.
Sherlock is a British character. Man from Uncle, British leads.
No, you're right. You're right.
The Gentleman, you know, it's a bunch of Brits. So it's still this idea.
Well, the Gentleman,
like,
is, yeah, yeah.
What if we give? It really is like, what if we give the guy who did Lock, Stock $100 million? Which, like, but isn't the craziest plan?
No, for sure not.
Totally worked.
I do. The question that I sort of am posing is, outside of Matthew Vaughn, who is obviously an acolyte, a producer of mm-hmm. Guy Ritchie's, I would argue maybe more successful. They're kind of on equal
the
level
trajectory
of success.
Has kind of gone, I think, like, Matthew Vaughn has at this point surpassed Guy Ritchie, maybe not in terms of name value, but definitely in like movies
box
that have
office.
Done
yeah.
better.
I like what Matthew Vaughn does a lot.
Yeah.
And it always has felt, that maybe I'm extrapolating, but, or maybe I'm, you know, reading too much into it, but it's always felt like he has a little chip on his shoulder, a little something to prove with everybody.
That's true. Because he started as a producer, and I imagine he feels that a little bit too. But my question was more about, I can't think of any other British filmmakers necessarily that took Guy Ritchie's baton and ran with it. Like, it still feels like the Brits are still making the fucking, you know, locked off camera BBC movies. It's like, even with the success of this, no one was like, you know what? Yeah, we should make like Energized. And everyone's like, no. Let's keep doing what we're doing. I think it's
maybe partially it has to do with the fact that, like, this kind of style, I think, just because of what Guy Ritchie is doing, like, is associated with this very kind of like macho kind of like take on the world, whereas like there are like British directors who are doing really interesting and different things, obviously, like in the independent space, but they're not at all like this kind of energy, so to speak. Like, again, pretty much all of Guy Ritchie's movies are operating on the basis of like, oh, isn't it cool to be a guy, like
yeah
I can tell you from experience it is.
Let me give a brief context and synopsis for people.
Before
who
you do it, one last thing.
Yeah.
The movie, being a guy is amazing. One last thing. This movie owes a tremendous debt of gratitude to Trainspotting.
Oh, yeah.
This Trainspotting really kind of, you know, kicked the door down. I don't even think this movie exists. There's no template for it without Trainspotting.
I agree.
There's, you know, modern template for it, and so I think that's interesting too. The Danny Boyle component, for sure.
Yes,
the guy he became, which was, you know, almost like, I hesitate to say, but almost Kubrick-esque, is like, I'll take on anything, you know, like whatever you got for me.
Let's win an Oscar.
Yeah.
Danny Boyle is one of those guys that, and I look forward to Blank Check someday doing him, because it feels like he's definitely a great filmography of just like a bunch of interesting stuff. Yeah. The guy's never made a boring movie. Yeah. He's made bad movies, but he's never made boring movies.
That's what's important, honestly.
I think it's very important. And I think that Guy Ritchie you know, you look at his filmography movies. And it's hard not to sort of see a guy who is just, there doesn't seem to be a point of view anymore, really. Like, he's just kind of making movies, he's getting paid, he's doing what he's doing. The vision and the specificity, whether you like this movie or not, and I'm not even the biggest fan of this movie either, but whether you like this film or not, you have to kind of be like, there's something here. And it feels like Hollywood saw that, people saw that, and I'm just not convinced that he has much to say anymore.
It's almost, it's almost an awesome movie. Karen, I have a question for you.
Mm-hmm.
Do you love this movie?
I really like it, honestly. Which I'm discovering I'm now in the minority on this podcast.
No, I don't think you're the most. I think we like it. I think we
I like it. I do like it. I don't hate it by any means. And this isn't, I think that it's more about, what was interesting about rewatching this film for me was the headspace I was in when I saw it in 99, the headspace I'm in now. I think I'm kinder to this film now mm-hmm. than I was then. I think back then I was kind of annoyed by it. I didn't feel like it felt derivative. It didn't feel as though, whereas now I kind of look at this thing. And again, with the perspective of being able to look at 20 some odd years of Guy Ritchie's career, it's given me a perspective to be able to enjoy this film, as Kenny said, as sort of the baby version of what Guy Ritchie has turned into. But yeah, I mean, let me just give this context real quick and then we can dive into the film. But Eddie convinces three friends.
Wait, we cut Karen off. Karen, you'd love this film.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure we'll talk about it more. I also had one other thing I wanted to say about Guy Ritchie, which is I feel like the last movie that he made that's really like just him doing his stuff is Wrath of Man, right? And I really didn't like it, but I know a lot of people that did, mm-hmm. which sort of does bring up the question for me, like, is the feeling that he doesn't have anything to say because he's been working on other people's stories, to put it very simply, mm-hmm. or like, I don't know, like, is, I don't know, it's like success affects people differently in terms of like how they think about the world and how they want to tell stories, so who knows.
Absolutely. I mean, I'm just looking at his filmography, just I'm gonna walk through it just so that we, whatever, you've got Lock, Stock, and Two Smoking Barrels, Snatch, Swept Away. We'll talk about the Madonna of it all because obviously that needs to be discussed at a certain point. Revolver, Rock and Rolla, Sherlock Holmes, Man from U.N.C.L.E., King Arthur, Aladdin, The Gentleman, Wrath of Man. And then he has three films that are coming out. He's got Operation Fortune, which I don't know what that is.
Isn't but
that I
think also that's a Jason Statham movie?
Yes, and I think that Aubrey Plaza's in it, if I'm not mistaken. And then... he's got Hercules, which is in pre-production on, which he's doing the live action version of that for Disney. You know, it's interesting.
That'll be a disaster.
It might. I mean, listen, I think we all thought Aladdin was going to be a disaster and then it made $1 billion. So like, I don't think it's a good movie. I didn't like Aladdin, but
Karen, as a
globally, person, they did
slightly younger than us, just slightly. Mm-hmm. And also a person who understands Disney and loves Disney to some extent. Mm-hmm. Am I right about that?
What, Aladdin being a disaster?
No. Do you like Hurricane? Do you like Hercules?
Yeah, I think it's fun. Although, I mean, I think it was just recent enough that it was like on the tail end of me being like the childhood age to be like, well, actually, you know, before I say that, let me check when Hercules came out. Okay, it's 1997, so I absolutely was not on the absolutely was not coming out of the
Disney.
My main memories though of Hercules are being like, oh, Hades is so cool, and that was about it. Oh, I really liked the dragons. I haven't seen this movie in a long time, and just looking at the poster on the Wikipedia, I'm like, oh yeah, there's this stuff. It's a fun movie. I like it.
I watched it for the Musker and Clemens Blank Check miniseries, but I'd never seen Hercules, so this was brand new to me.
Mm-hmm.
I really loved the style of animation.
Yeah.
I thought that some of the songs were cool. But I'm also just sort of like, it didn't make much of an imprint or an impact, I felt like,
not
at the time.
Not the way a lot of the other contemporary Disney films did,
right,
for sure.
Which I'm sort of like, I mean, okay, yeah, I guess you can do this one in live action, but I'm just not sure why we're doing it, but you know.
Yeah.
Well, Disney, that's just what they do now.
Yeah,
they'll do everyone, but maybe I'm a baby, but my issue with it was I was very into that, you know, and still am into that, you know, that what are they, the Disney Renaissance run.
Sure.
And I love all those films up to and including Pocahontas.
Sure.
And they all follow the same formula more or less. And Disney, and like, there's a little bit of social commentary in Aladdin, mm-hmm. a little bit of snark, a little, and you know, not really in the other ones. And I'm okay with a little bit, even though that turned me off. You know, I'm looking for more or less straight up fairy tales out of this stuff. Hercules is like different. Hercules is like, it's Michael weird. Jordan is kind of annoying, you know, like Hercules is like Hercules is like, you know, Michael Jordan, he totally sold out to Nike, didn't he? Yeah. And it's like, I'm like, yeah. Come on, what are we doing here?
I don't know that
Hercules straight up is like superheroing isn't as pure as it used to be.
It's the beginning of Hercules is the close. It's interesting because I feel like Disney sort of stays away, at least the Renaissance one, from being kind of meta and winky.
Yes.
You know what I mean? Like, Aladdin is only insofar as that they put a microphone in front of Robin Williams and said, just talk. And he did. Yeah. And so there's a bunch of pop culture references. But I do feel like...
And it's siloed off to this one yes. character. And it's, you know, sure. and that's kind of true for Lion King as well. Like, Timon and Pumbaa are kind of playing a different game yeah. than the rest of them. But whatever. And, I don't care. I'm enjoying
yeah,
it.
Yeah, for sure. It's, I guess my point is that Disney and I guess in turn Pixar have never really been Shrekified. Like, they've never gone full DreamWorks where like they become sort of yes. this weird meta crawling inside themselves thing. And I do feel like Hercules was treading a line.
That's exactly what I'm feeling, Phil. So, I was going to make a Shrek point, but I think it predates Shrek, doesn't it?
It does.
Yeah.
It does.
Yeah.
Just barely. Yeah.
It probably was it was probably like
proto Shrek.
Katzenberg was probably like, this is the one. this is the jam. One they'll remember me by. All right.
Okay.
Give
so
us
the
some
synopsis
context
of this
Bill.
Film. Eddie convinces three friends to pool funds for a high stake poker game against local crime boss Hatchet Harry. Harry cheats and Eddie loses, giving him a week to pay back £500,000 or hand over his father's pub. Desperate Eddie and his friends wait for their neighbors to rob some drunk dealers, then rob the robbers in turn. After both thefts, the number of interested criminal parties increases, with the four friends in dangerously over their heads. Lock, Stock, and Two Smoky Barrels opened on March 5th, 1999, against Analyze This, Cruel Intentions, 8mm, The Other Sister, and Payback. What a murderer's row of movies that is. Only one genuine masterpiece. We have done all of them. Yeah. It would go on to make $28 million on a $1.4 million budget. It's got 75% on Rotten Tomatoes from critics, 93% from audiences. This was a movie that really, I mean, as I was going to mention earlier, working in a video store, this was a big video store movie. Like, mm-hmm. this was one of those, like, was constantly rented, constantly out. Everyone felt like they discovered some fucking gem that they, you know, that no one had heard of. And as you can imagine, a lot of bros, a lot of college guys coming in to rent Lock, Stock, Two Smoking Barrels and Boondock Saints and probably Donnie Darko as well.
I'm pretty sure I had a poster for this when I was
really?
In college. Yeah.
So these were Karen boys, early Karen boys.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I think Roger the line goes to like League of Extraordinary Gentlemen. I was like, oh, Jason Fleming is great. And then I sought this out later on because of that.
Jason Fleming does very much feel like
he's always good.
Yeah, he is always good. I do feel like my brain, and this might be unfair, does blend him with Risa Foss.
Well, they both have like sad eyes.
They both have sad and like extreme features. Like,
yeah,
I
but
do
Jason
feel
Fleming's
like
yeah. sharper.
Yes,
he's like
mm-hmm. yes.
hit sharpen on Reese.
But both yeah. look like they could also be stop motion.
I think
they yeah, could yeah, also yeah, be yeah, made yeah. out of clay. Yeah, yeah. Roger Ebert gave the film 3 stars. Said Lock, Stock, and Two Smoking Barrels is like Tarantino crossed with the Marx Brothers if Groucho had been into chopping off fingers. It's a bewilderingly complex caper film set among the low lives of London's East End, and we don't need to be told that the director used to make TV commercials. We figure that out when a cook throws some veggies into water and the camera shoots up from the bottom of the pot. By the end of it all, you're reeling while trying to make sense of the plot. Lock, Stock, and Two Smoking Barrels seems like an exercise in
style than anything else. And so it is. We don't care much about the characters. We realize the film style stands outside the material and is lathered on top. There are freeze frames, jokey subtitles, speed up, slow motion, and the characters are controlled by the demands of a clockwork plot. But Lockstock is fun in a slapdash way. It has exuberance in a time when movies follow formulas like zombies. It's alive. I can't argue with any of that. Like, I do think that in 99, you know, as Kenny and I have obviously spent the last 4 years doing, has there's a plethora of movies and the spectrum is wide. But in terms of the things that popped, it's understandable why something like this would pop.
Yeah.
Right. Like, I think in a post Pulp Fiction universe, in a sort of, you know, whatever, it is interesting. Like, Boondock. Did Boondock get a theatrical release? I can't even remember if it did. It might have briefly.
I think it got a very, very limited release. I think we're talking about like 30,000 in theaters or something like that.
Right. Because this is one of the early films I can remember that was like a working title movie. Mm-hmm. And again, I'm sure there are earlier ones than this. So forgive me. I don't necessarily know the history of that company. But I just remember, like, I get why, like, comes at a Sundance. It's a big hit overseas. It doesn't get released here until I think 6 or 8 months after its release in the UK. And they sort of have the wind at their back. I get why it all kind of pops. But then I also kind of, I find myself going, like, imagining a bunch of, forgive me, American bro-y college students sitting back and watching this film. And it's kind of hilarious to think about. Because, like, I don't imagine they understand half the shit these people are saying. and it takes place in basically a culture that they are completely unaware of. I just think it's kind of interesting.
Yeah, but I would argue that for that particular value of why you're going to the movie theater, it is not super crucial for you to understand it. Totally. Because something is constantly happening. Like, there's no pauses in this movie. It's always something happening.
Yeah.
And even if your understanding of it is pretty cursory, like, it still has an arc to it. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
It's a manic movie. And I do think that, and we really talked about this, Kenny, so I think it's worth talking about for a second, just in terms of for 99 context of, like, manic movies that are kind of like in your face and trying to kind of keep your attention, because obviously that is really run with through the 2000s, right? But in the 90s, you only had sort of pockets of filmmakers, and I would argue better filmmakers at it, of doing stuff that's kind of in your face aesthetically and visually and from a filmmaking perspective. So it is interesting that we learned all the wrong lessons from these types of movies. Do you sort of know what I'm getting at?
Yeah, no, I do. I also love those type of movies.
I love
being just assaulted by vision and sound, you know?
That's Lerman, baby.
Yeah, exactly. By far the thing I like least about movies is when I'm bored.
Sure.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's the greatest sin to me is boring. Mm-hmm. So I'll take anything Baz has ever done over a lot of other filmmakers, just because at least there's something to chew on there. Mm-hmm. No matter what. Yeah, no, I think you're right. I mean the other thing I think we've done a ton of, and I had no idea about this before we started this podcast, mm-hmm. was how many, like, Pulp Fiction-y, Reservoir-y, crime capery knockoffs we've done. And some are like really, really, really good movies. Yep. Like, you know, I thought Two Hands was one of the better movies we've done. Mm-hmm. But, and this is also, like, you know, kind of in the in the top,
in that lane. Yeah.
In the top quarter of the ones we've done. But it really is amazing how much money was thrown at people who think they can be the next Tarantino.
Yeah, it's funny. I mean, like, we constantly see this happening where everyone's like, what's the next Game of Thrones? And it's like, doesn't work that way. It doesn't work that way.
Sometimes you have so many imitators, right? Sometimes you just, like, some of these things, tons. We're now, I would say on the flip side, we're now 7 years into Stranger Things being a massive hit, and nobody has really, like, given put their weight behind trying to make the next Stranger Things, which is kind of crazy to me.
So my roommate who works at a studio told me an incredible story a few months ago. Maybe it was longer now that I think about it. It was after Squid Game had dropped. Mm-hmm. So forgive me. I don't remember when that was. But it's one of my favorite stories. So Squid Game's this big fat hit, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. So she's in a staff meeting and without naming names, obviously, one of the people in this meeting says, one of the bosses says, so have any of you guys passed on any Squid Games recently? Like the idea that, like, I mean, that to me exemplifies everything about Hollywood, right?
Yeah.
Big hit. How can it's just heat seeking missile shit where you're just like, yeah. How do we capitalize on that thing? And I do think that you're absolutely right, Kenny. You know, the juggernaut that happens in the mid to late 90s of Tarantino and even Paul Thomas Anderson with Boogie Nights and all these sort of like really exciting new voices. It's understandable why everyone would be trying to find their version of that. But
part of why Tarantino is so thrilling and amazing mm-hmm. is because I think you look at what he does and who he is. And I think so many aspiring filmmakers and also executives and producers are like, mm-hmm. we can do that. You know, this isn't that hard. This is, yep. you know, this is basic camera packages. These are simple locations. These are, you know,
so naive,
generally speaking, like gettable actors, yeah. right? Yeah. I mean, yeah. by Pulp Fiction, even like the whole point of Pulp Fiction was Travolta was like eminently gettable all the time. So mm-hmm. like, these are like gettable actors. These are like songs no one has like heard of. People are giving to you. Mm-hmm. And Tarantino is not a guy I went to film school, just mm-hmm. a geek at a video store. You know, so just like we can pull all these randoms. I mean, that's the story of Troy Duffy, just another schmuck with a camera. Right?
Troy Duffy is exactly that. I mean, Troy Duffy is the, like, yeah.
He's a loud schmuck with a camera who loves yeah. film and thinks he can yeah. do everything too. So I think that that's why, at least as far as I'm putting it together, it's not only that Reservoir Dogs, Pulp Fiction, and, you know, kind of to a lesser extent because he kind of had his feet firmly on the ground by the time he did Jackie Brown. But why those movies in particular, spawn so many imitators.
Because there's this idea of
we can do that.
It's deceptively simple is ultimately what it comes down to.
And I would say there are fewer imitators of a Paul Thomas Anderson, even though there are plenty, but there are fewer because, like, you know, the amount of research that goes into a Boogie Nights, the amount of, you know, the amount of craft and production design, that is, and 3-hour epic of it all, that is such a heavy lift.
Well, he's also, I would argue that Paul Thomas Anderson is much more of a moving target than Tarantino is in terms of like the genres and the things that he's, I mean, it's clear to me anyway, and I think it's probably clear to everybody that, like, you know, his influences post Boogie Nights became so much more diverse, right? Like mm-hmm. it just felt as though the expanse of his of what he found interesting just became so much broader, because I imagine if you're Paul Thomas Anderson, you don't want to be a Tarantino clone, despite mm-hmm. the fact that Boogie Nights got tagged with that a little bit back in the day. I do think that, you know, Magnolia is much more of a Robert Altman film than it is anything else, right? Like, and obviously, you know, you look at all the different sort of films he's made since. He's a fascinating guy. Tarantino, and I would argue, we're going to do Inglourious Bastards on our Patreon in a few weeks with David Ehrlich, which we're very excited to do. And we'll sort of unpack Tarantino in sort of all his glory, I guess, because there is a spectrum there, but it's a little bit narrower, right? Like in terms of what he wants to say, or at least the type of films that he makes.
Yeah, I think again, you know, we're pretty far afield, but I think by Kill Bill, it wasn't so much that he was outside of the spectrum, but like it was almost this conical shape coming out of it. Which is now I'm going to envelop everything that I've ever seen.
Yeah, he kind of swallowed the entire spectrum of filmmaking, I guess, and kind of put it through. But his
then,
own
of
prism.
Course, you know, I think Inglourious Basterds is a complete masterpiece, and I think part of it is because it is so different from so many of his films until it becomes a Tarantino film,
Inglourious Basterds,
which I love.
I
love that he kind of found the Tarantino film in that film, but. You know, started with basically a fucking Sergio Leone film. I mean, like, what's the name of the movie?
The first chapter of that, it's insane. It's so good.
Yeah. So a question for you guys for Lockstock, and forgive me if I missed this, because Lord knows this film, I was paying attention, and yet some of it I just got lost in. Who's narrating this movie?
The friend.
Is it the friend?
It's Sting's friend, yeah.
Oh, it's Sting's friend. Okay, yes,
it's Sting's friend. Because I couldn't at the end when he comes out.
At the end, we meet. Okay, okay.
Yeah, at the end, it's whoever that guy is.
It's just because the narration, which is quite frankly a little clunky, like it's a little hand-holding. Which by the way, like I imagine is a necessity, right? Like without the narration, you'd be completely fucking lost. Mm-hmm. So I understand the importance of it. I was waiting for the reveal and clearly I missed it, but I of where this voice was coming from. But yeah, it's what are your thoughts on narration, Karen? What are your thoughts on V? Because people seem to fucking hate it. And I'm sort of, I don't know. I think it's.
I mean, then ultimately, this is kind of a boring answer, but ultimately, I feel the same way about it as I do about any other kind of narrative tool, which is like, as long as you use it well, it's fine. I don't care. It's very easy to use it badly.
No, for sure. I remember
sometimes the boring answers are the right answers.
No, for sure. I read a quote from Frank Darabont years ago where he was doing Shawshank, I think. And you know, as we're all told in film school, like, don't use narration. It's a crutch, blah, blah, blah. So he was trying to write Shawshank without narration. And then Goodfellas was on television and he watched and he was like, fuck them. It's like, because the narration in Goodfellas is just obviously perfect. And it's just like, to your point, if you do it well, who gives a shit if it's a crutch? I mean,
the novella is told, it's first person from Red's point of view. I couldn't conceive of trying to tell that story any other way.
Yeah. It
would be fucking awful, actually. Like,
for sure. It
really would be. Like, so much of that is the way Red observes Andy.
I also just think that you know, narration by and large, I understand people's concerns with it, critics who feel it's too hand-holdy, this, that, and whatever. But I'll tell you what they'll hate even more. Bad expositional fucking dialogue comes out of people's mouths that is necessary in order to forward the fucking plot.
That broadcast pilot stuff where brothers and sisters call each other bro and sis. Wait, Phil, I have a question for you. And Karen, you too.
Uh-huh.
Have you guys ever used VO in a script? Like narration, like this kind of VO.
No. But I haven't written as many as you guys, so.
Here's my thing. In television, I kind of love it. Like, I actually really, you know, one of my favorite things about TV is that Carrie Bradshaw can just fucking talk over an episode and give you that structure. I love that Felicity has a fucking dictaphone and she's talking to... you know, one of her teachers back home. Like, I love that device, so I have used it in pilots. I was going to use it in Dealey. I was told not to, but I do think that it can be great. It feels like such a lovely, almost nostalgic broadcast thing to do. We don't see it anymore, really.
Veronica Mars did it. My so-called life
Veronica
did
Mars
it.
Did it. Yes, yes, yes.
I mean, I think that these. I mean, we happen to kind of name four YA-ish female protagonist shows.
We did.
I think I can't remember ever using it for all the reasons that we're talking.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
talking about. You are shamed out of using it. And whatever you like, and whenever you like, feel like maybe we should do VO here. Mm-hmm. Like it's out of any narrative tool, it is the biggest thing that you have to like steel yourself. You're like, all right, I'm going to defend this. I have the reasons why I need it. Like I'm writing something right now. I remember there was something that I remember. I was like, should we do VO here? I'm like, yeah, maybe we should. And then I'm writing, I'm not doing it because I'm a wimp. Now I'm thinking about doing it. I actually have only read the outline, not the pilot. Now I'm thinking maybe I should do it. Fuck it.
I think VO, I mean, I genuinely believe that VO is one of those things that people complain about, and I just don't think it's a thing that's worth bitching about, quite honestly. To Karen's point, VO's great. Total side question, on a completely different note. This is Jason Statham's first movie. Jason Statham
and
apparently
VO and fucking Citizen Kane.
They do. Yeah. Jason Statham, who apparently
this is all you're going to be thinking about now for the rest of the episode.
You know that, Karen. I'm like, yeah. I've been working on this argument for about 15 years, right? Like, it just occurred to me. I'm like, wait, and also maybe obviously also fucking Sunset Boulevard, which is where my head went first.
It's a perfect fucking movie, exactly. Yeah.
Sunset Boulevard, but also like Citizen Kane. It goes to the top.
So my question is, Jason Statham, who apparently hasn't aged a day in 25 years, who looked the same,
He's
outside of
great right now.
He looks great. No, I'm certainly not complaining. Jason Statham is quite good in this, considering it's the first thing he's ever done. It's also the first movie that Vinnie Jones has ever been in.
Also,
who's also amazing.
Great. Yeah, he's also great. I do think it's interesting that. I mean, more so Jason than Vinny, because Vinny's career is puttered out a little bit. But I do think that Jason Statham has found ways to show the range he's got, right? Like, the guy can obviously do your action films, but he does get the joke. And I guess this is all just a long way of saying that Guy Ritchie sees in him, taps into him in this film, kind of goes away a little bit, because I feel like he becomes kind of just a heavy for a little while, but I do feel like it's come back around a bit, and now he's tapping a little bit more into the humor that he has in this.
This was honestly the most surprising thing for me when I was watching this movie. Like, obviously I'd seen it before, but I think this is the first time that I really noticed like how like not furrowed Jason Statham's brow is in this the whole time. Like, it's very open, just very normal. Yeah. And that makes him look younger than he is. Like, just because we're so used to him looking like the tough guy all the time now, even like in the roles where he's comedically, where he's being funny, where it's like, I think we're all thinking about Spy and how good he is in that movie.
He's very good
Spy. But even in that, like, the joke is on like the image that he's cultivated rather than necessarily like allowing him to be funny in a more kind of light way. All that to say, he's a really good actor. I think he's
great. He is. I really have to say that watching this, I'm not sure that I ever fully understood the Jason Statham thing until I saw this film, if I'm being completely honest. And it's not to say that I don't like him in the Fast movies or that I don't like him in Spy. He's funny as all that. But I think to your point, it's a commentary, right? Like, it's this meta thing that he's doing. Watching him in this, I'm like, yeah, that guy's a star. Like, I can understand why people thought he could be a star. You know, I do wonder whether or not hopefully he can branch out even more and he can start sort of showing more colors than just kind of this this commentary on the heavy that he does. But again, like, you kind of nailed it. He's not furrowed.
He's just very charming.
Yeah. Yes, yes.
I also think, like, this also speaks to something that I like about Guy Ritchie's movies in general, which is I think he's a really good eye for actors.
I agree with that. Yeah. I agree with that. And showing, I mean, listen, I never saw The Gentleman, so I can't speak to The Gentleman. But I do think that looking at, and again, everyone's favorite cannibal, Armie Hammer.
It's a lot. There's a lot going on right now. Yeah.
In Man from U.N.C.L.E., I do think that
my favorite cannibal.
He's favorite cannibal. I think that I'm obviously joking, but I do think that that movie, Alicia Vikander playing essentially almost like an Audrey Hepburn type role, All four of those leads, I would argue, are playing kind of against type in doing things that you know, even Hugh Grant shows up. He's very funny in that film. Like, I agree with you. I do think that I wouldn't necessarily have thought of some of these people in the way that he does think of them.
Yeah, I mean, especially if you look at the supporting cast of all his big movies, like, he really knows, like, how to pick his actors. Like, I feel like he is kind of the first director, well, maybe not if you count, like, TV stuff, but at least in terms of film, like, these are some of the first big roles that, like, Mark Strong had with Revolver and Rock and Roll. And he's really, really good in those. And I can see, like, producers being mad that he wouldn't cast like a more famous person in those roles, especially in Rock and Roll, where he is very prominent in it, where, like, I don't know, he's just good at casting good actors who aren't necessarily the first people you think of for given role.
I agree with that 100%. I think that, I mean, listen, there's a necessity in the film like this of casting people that obviously, you know, are newbies, relatively cheap, that kind of stuff. You get who you can, and I do think that can go badly too, right? Like, we've seen many films over the course of 99 Canny of just sort of people that are put into movies because they just need these roles filled, and you know it doesn't go well. There are 44 speaking parts in this film. 17 of them were by people that had never acted before.
Wow.
Which is pretty unbelievable when you think about it.
Yeah.
It's pretty crazy. There's also this somewhat ludicrous story that basically the film was having trouble finding a distributor. So one of the actors, one of the producers, someone knew Tom Cruise, crazily enough. And he attended a screening. And Matthew Vaughn later recalled it was hysterical. You had all these mid-level executives sitting there. Cruise walks in. He saw them all sit up and pay attention, all getting on their phones. Suddenly, all these senior executives are joining the screening. And at the end, Tom stands up and says, "This is the best movie I've seen in years. You guys would be fools not to buy it."
Wow.
Which is insane. I do think, though, there's something interesting about, like, I mean, listen, we could do many, many hours on Tom Cruise. And I do think that Tom Cruise has an eye for directors, an eye for people that make sense, that can break through. I mean, he almost made Mission Impossible 3 with Matthew Carnahan all those many years ago after he saw Narc. Like, I do think that he's a guy who can see your potential, right? You know? Joe Carnahan, my apologies. It's not surprising that he sat down and watched a Guy Ritchie film and was like, "This guy's got something." Mm-hmm. And I would watch a Guy Ritchie Tom Cruise movie. Whatever that is.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think that's, I don't know. I used to have a real bee in my bonnet, if you will, about Guy Ritchie, because I felt like I wasn't sure that there was any there.
I didn't know that about you.
Yeah, I think part of it is, again, stems from seeing this in 99, probably just being a fucking film snob. You know, I was in my first year of film school at the time. I'm sure I thought myself, you know, to be some sort of auteur. And I'm sure I watched this film and was just kind of annoyed by it. And now I kind of look at his filmography, and I, you know, not to belabor the point, but I do think Sherlock Holmes, Man from U.N.C.L.E. show that this guy isn't just a gun for hire, that he can give you something a little bit more. So I'm curious to see what, you know, he continues doing.
I never had a really good sense of what the critical consensus was of pre-Hollywood Guy Ritchie. Mm-hmm. I never really got if people thought he was a budding auteur or a ripoff artist or something in between. I had the sense that people really liked Lock, Stock. I didn't have the sense that people didn't like Lock, Stock. You know, like, it definitely didn't feel like it was Boondocks, you know, where people were like, "Fuck that film." It felt more like this is good elevated pulp, you know, and that's what it always kind of seemed to me, was like, this is good elevated pulp.
Yep.
And Guy Ritchie is more good than bad.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure, like your reaction in terms, and I assume that this was shared by a lot of people you knew at the time. your reaction, I didn't really realize people had. I didn't realize a lot of people saw that and went, essentially, this guy's a fraud.
No, just to be clear, I don't know that I thought he was a fraud necessarily. I just think that I have a vague recollection of seeing it with a friend who was big into sort of British stuff and just feeling a little bit like,
I'm sure that guy wasn't annoying at all.
You know, and I just felt kind of like, yeah, okay, sure. It's weird because watching it now, it honestly feels kind of quaint. And I don't say that in a patronizing way. Like it does feel like it is quaint, right? I mean,
yes.
A lot of the 99 films we've covered have that sort of vibe, if you will, right? Especially with the younger filmmakers. But do you remember, Karen, when you saw it first? Do you remember sort of
It would have been end of high school, early college for me, which, again, I literally specifically sought it out because I like a bunch of the actors in it. Yeah. For that value, I really liked it. And I also think, like, this is around the time where I was also really starting to get into Tarantino as well, whereas, like, it really worked for me. And watching it again now, it honestly is really impressive to me that this was what Ritchie's first feature that he directed. Like, it's really impressive. And that's does everything that it needs to, I think, really, really well. Mm-hmm. And to a certain extent, like, I feel like this plus Snatch, which I think did pretty well when it came Snatch out or was well. Really yes. well received, mm-hmm. like, it explains a lot about why he got Sherlock Holmes. Because I don't think Revolver and Rock'n'Rolla had the same kind of impact that these movies did, and obviously Swept Away didn't. But, like, the legacy that this movie and Snatch had was enough to get him Sherlock Holmes.
Yeah, I mean, Snatch is one of those films too that Snatch cost $10 million, made just shy of 100. So like, yeah, they're laughing all the way to the bank on that one. Benicio mm-hmm. del Toro, Dennis Farina, Vinnie Jones, Brad Pitt. The thing that I remember most is that Brad Pitt's unintelligible through the entire film, which feels like a wink to the fact that people probably didn't understand Lock, Stock, and Two Smoking Barrels, but in terms of the accents. But yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right. You know, it's Joel Silver is the guy who produces Rock'n'Rolla, if I'm not mistaken. I also believe he produce Sherlock Holmes as well. Am I making that up?
Seems like the kind of thing he might do.
Because he if it wasn't him, it certainly was Village Roadshow, and that they were the same studio. This is all just a long way of saying that it's all kind of interconnected, right? Like Rock'n'Rolla does well enough, I assume. How did Rock'n'Rolla do?
Joel Silver did do Sherlock Holmes.
Yeah, okay. And Rock'n'Rolla cost 18 and made 25, so it didn't do great. But I imagine that, to your point, Karen, it showed that the guy had a visual acuity and a style that could be smart for Sherlock Holmes. I mean, listen, Sherlock Holmes is definitely a Guy Ritchie movie. You still have slow motion bare knuckle fucking boxing. It's not a Guy Ritchie movie. but I do think that I don't know. I tried to watch Man from U.N.C.L.E. again recently, and it's just a charming movie. And part of it, I think, is just the source material and casting and Guy Ritchie kind of getting out of his own way and just letting it be what it is. It's not to say that I'm sure. Did you guys ever hear of the rumors of there was a George Clooney Man from U.N.C.L.E. that Soderbergh was trying to direct? So that was like that was sort of a post Oceans. They were going to do that. Oh, it would have been unbelievable, but I guess Soderbergh was asking for like some astronomical budget, and ultimately it didn't happen. The irony, of course, being they spent a fraction of the money on this version and it flopped. So you know,
well, still, it's kind of Man from U.N.C.L.E. I think has like I'm gonna exaggerate. I think it has like 8 credited writers.
Yes,
and I think part of it is it was like a 15-year process using all these elements from all these different scripts and all these different ideas and. It sounds like Ritchie somehow can sign that into a movie.
Into a movie that, quite honestly, I remember I saw it with friends and we all left the theater and being like, that was fun. Like, I don't understand why everyone's shitting on this thing. You did or didn't?
No, I don't.
Okay, that's totally fine. I obviously, it's, but I do wonder whether or not, to Kenny's point, also just the history of the project felt very much like Warner Brothers is like, we have a franchise on our hands here. Mm-hmm. Like if we do this right, we could have, you know, a playful spy type thing that we could do a bunch of. I mean, even just in the casting of Henry Cavill and at the time Armie Hammer, both of those are guys that are in theory on the way up. I mean, it could have been a big success. The whole cast is, but it's just yeah, this is all just a long way of saying. And then did you see King Arthur, Karen? King Arthur is fucking bonkers. That movie is crazy weird.
Yeah, it's not like a great movie, I would say, but it's very fun.
It is. What are your Charlie Hunnam thoughts?
If he has the right material, he can be really good. Like, I'm still obsessed with The Lost City of Zed. Like, I think he's really, really good in that. That movie is perfect. But, like, I haven't liked him in everything that I've seen. So yeah. It feels like it's very much dependent on the material and maybe also the director.
Yeah. Do you have Charlie Hunnam thoughts?
I have none.
Charlie Hunnam, who, I mean, obviously Sons of Anarchy, an enormous show, a big hit, and an attempt, you know, many attempts have been made to transition him to features. You know, I like him in the Guillermo del Toro movies, but he also just sort of feels like, why are you in Crimson Peak, Charlie? Like, what are you doing in this movie? Like, I liked him fine in Pacific Rim. I still think it's hilarious that he was almost Christian Grey which, I mean, I don't know what that looks like, but sure. It is what it is, but
yeah,
this is all just a long way of saying that I think he's an interesting guy. It's an interesting call for him to be King Arthur. It's a weird King Arthur take.
Yeah.
But yeah, I don't know. I didn't hate this movie. The more we talk about this movie, the more I liked this movie, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. I really didn't like it back in the day, but now I'm finding myself sort of thinking about how, and this is going to be a weird thing to say, all things considered, how light a touch this movie has.
Yeah. Yeah.
I agree with that though. I think you're right.
Yeah. Do you know what I'm saying? Like, I don't think that this movie is trying to say or do too much. It just wants to be a fun ride.
Yep.
And it's hard to hate on a movie like that.
It's not trying. I mean, I was thinking the same thing throughout, because there is no subtext here. Mm-hmm. This is kind of like a firmly middle brow movie, even though it's made for not a lot of money, in that I generally think a middle brow movie is a movie that just kind of says what it says, you know. Mm-hmm. it's just kind of telling you what it's about.
Yeah.
And doing it in a pretty straightforward way. It doesn't aspire to be high art. It is it doesn't aspire to be trash that, you know, could be kind of reconstructed later. It's a story. Yeah. I think it's a plot driven caper. I think the bones of the plot and the caper are pretty fucking fantastic.
Yeah.
I like the twists. I like the, you know, I like the introduction of new characters and new obstacles. I think the stuff with the cage is pretty funny. I think the inciting incident is deeply stupid, but that doesn't really matter that much. Like, I think it's, I there's such an easier way to get him to owe the money than have something that would never in a million years happen in a game of poker.
Yeah.
Basically, like, you don't have to take the loan from the guy you're playing against. You could have taken a loan from the house and then owed the house. Like, it's just like, that's just the one thing where it's just like, have you played poker before? But that's fine. It's like, yeah, go ahead.
I also just want to say too, one thing that this movie does really well is camaraderie.
Mm-hmm.
That's a really hard thing to do. Part of it's in the casting, but part of it, you know, Kenny, you're absolutely right in terms of like the framing and the blocking and this, that. I agree, all that stuff is not great. But what he is able to do is capture an energy and a chemistry between the characters. And that's an exceedingly hard thing to do. It's a vibe and you want to hang out with these people. And that is so vitally important. If you didn't want to hang out with these people, you're obviously toast. But it also just feels like sometimes the director just can't seem to just let these people be. And sometimes it just feels like the camera's just there and you're just, Specifically, I'm thinking about basically the bar scenes where I imagine we're all drunk anyway, which is fine. But I those scenes, especially the end, which you were referring to earlier, Kenny, which, you know, obviously I want to talk about, like, there's just a vibe of a bunch of buddies that just can't seem to get out of their own way.
Yeah.
And that's really fun to watch. Hard to hate on.
I agree with you.
So what are your thoughts on the end, Kenny, which you mentioned earlier?
Oh yeah.
Well, I thought the sorry, coughing it up. I think the end is kind of typical up until the end, right? So in the end, the most sympathetic character, which is Big Chris, Vinny Jones, who walks around with little Chris, his little son, who's threatened at some point.
Love.
Walks
them.
Away with all, so great. Walks away with all the money and a great monologue. everyone looks like a bunch of fools in the aftermath. But he leaves him with this one little, like parting gift, which is those guns you stole from these old people are actually worth
a lot of money.
Quite a lot of quid, if you will.
About $1 million, all things considered.
About $1 million.
300,000 pounds. So,
one of the schmoes also had just left to go get rid of them because they're evidence in the crime they committed.
Mm-hmm. He was berated and told to get rid of them, to be clear.
Yes, because he was a moron for keeping them around. Yes, so these guys, at that moment, it's so slapsticky. So the guy goes to get rid of it. They all have these cell phones. They call. They try to call him. Meanwhile, he's throwing these guns off the bridge, but they landed on a ledge, so there's still a chance to get it back. So as he is either trying to retrieve these guns or push them over and halfway over the ledge himself, holding on and with his cell phone in his mouth for, you know, God knows what reason, but it works perfectly. Yeah. he gets this call, which, you know, the other line is save the guns, but he's unable to answer the call. It is so, you almost hear the Curb Your Enthusiasm music playing.
Yeah.
It is so funny and silly. And like, it is just, it is, to me, it's almost like a fucking Magnolia, but it did happen moment, which is like, take this that seriously, guys. It's a silly crime caper. It's almost like a broadside shot against potential critics who might be like, yet another overly violent crime movie. It's a it's fun. It's silly.
Yeah.
I couldn't agree with you
more. Crazy about it. It's the only part of the movie that, and I think this actually, you know, redeems the entire movie, that makes me feel like Guy Ritchie's one of us. You know, it's like you're not trying to be like a super cool, like Troy Duffy guy who makes movies about slow-mo and like blood and like splatter shots.
Yeah.
It's like, no, movies are fun. You just saw a fun movie. Like, there's just fun shit, right, guys?
Yeah, totally. It's a really good ending to basically drive across, like, don't take it too serious.
Yep. There's two things that occurred to me as you were talking, Kenny. The first is, I love that the guy's name is Troy Duffy. It's the perfect fucking name ever. Like, it just, of course, his name is Troy Duffy. But that being said, often people have talked about how you have your audience leave a movie, right? That the final moments before the credits roll, that's how you're going to be remembered by your audience, right? And the end of this film is so perfect, it made me enjoy what came before it that much more.
Yeah.
So like, you can't ask more from an ending than an ending that makes you smile, that makes you go, that's funny, but also makes you think like, oh yeah, I mean, this whole thing has been in this vibe. And maybe I just haven't been thinking about it through the right, you know, lens. I do think that there's something great about it being a freeze frame as well. Generally speaking, knowing how it's going to end is, you know, can sometimes be a crutch, can sometimes be like, I don't really know.
It had to be this ending.
It really did. It's a lot more fun than I remembered it being.
Mm-hmm.
As confused as I might have been about some of the turns and some of the stuff that was going on at times, it ends on the absolutely perfect note for this movie.
Yeah.
So let's rate this, because Karen, I'm curious. I want to ask you about the film that we're covering next week. I don't know if you know these filmmakers, but I'm And maybe you do. So, Kenny, what are your thoughts? What's your rating on this?
Oh, I actually wrote it down like a grown-up. So hold on.
Like a grown-up?
Sure. Like a responsible person.
Yeah, sure.
Said it just off the top of my brain. I wrote down a lot of things. Okay. All right. So I gave it a 70. Go against it today.
What did you think back in the day?
Back in the day. Sorry. So I never really thought much of this film. I certainly didn't dislike it, but I never thought it was great. And I think you guys know intimately, I am the opposite of an Anglophile. I think the Brits are miserable fucks.
Wait, Kenny, have you seen RRR?
I can't wait to see RRR.
I just have to find
3 hours, but
you have to.
Is it about how horrible Brits are?
Yeah, it's all just dunking on Brits for 3 hours.
Well, the thing with Brits, and I'm sure the experience for Indians is different, but the thing with Brits is they fucking hate us. They think we are the worst. They hate themselves too,
it seems like.
Great. But they hate us. And we sit here and we give them our awards and we act like the Beatles are ours. We act like real art and culture comes from them sipping tea with their pinkies up. And anything like In the Loop is a good example. Yes, anything that like with British people taking the piss out of British people is wonderful to me.
Yes,
because I'm like, oh, you see, you're the bad guys. Like you're the villains in this relationship. It's not us plucky Americans constantly trying to like prove to you to our big brother that we're like worthy of having like a fucking China dinner with, China dinner with. I hate the Brits.
Okay. So here's what I'm unpack here.
The reason I bring it up is because I've always kind of blanched at the notion that British people or British movies are more sophisticated, specifically because they are just coming from that country. And I think that that's a case for a lot of people. I think that there's a particular type of, quote unquote film bro who there's a great character in Band Slam, Phil, of that guy the bassist who puts on a British accent in the whole movie because he thinks that great musicians are British. I think that happens with kind of this idea like British crime, that there's like something sophisticated to the way they kill people and rob people and screw people over. And I've always had kind of a pit in my stomach about that. So Locksack always kind of rubbed me the wrong way for that particular reason, Trainspotting the opposite, obviously, which is Brits are fuck ups too. Like, I know, I've been saying that the whole time. I think I probably would have given it about a 61 before. Like, fun movie, but like ultimately, like, get out of here with your Brits are cooler than Americans. After this conversation, and having grown up and moving past my anti-British thoughts to some extent.
Sure.
I'm going to give it like a 76. I think I do want this, I want it noted and recorded that I like this movie and I'm happy we did it. And I was a little nervous that I wasn't going to like it. And I'm really kind of thrilled that I rewatched it. I don't think I'd seen it in 23 years. So it's a good movie.
How about you, Karen? What'd you think back in the day and what are you thinking now?
I liked it a lot back in the day and I still like it a lot. I think I would rate it like an 80 or 85 or something like that. Okay. Just because there are some moments in which you can tell it's very much a product of its time.
Sure.
That you would not put in your movie today. But it's still really fun. I think it's really well made. It's really well cast. Guy Ritchie is a fun director. I like it. I think it's fun.
Very succinct. Yeah, I mean, back in 99, as I said, I wasn't a fan of this movie. I probably would have given it like a 57 back then. I think that I was just sort of, just a snobby film student, what have you. Watching it the other day, liked it a lot more. Probably gave it about a 70. And now I'm at like a 75, I'd say. Like, I think that it's, I think it's a better movie than I gave credit to back in the day, certainly. And, I really do think that the years and having seen another Guy Ritchie film since have helped me appreciate this film more than I did back in its time. So next week, Karen, Do you have thoughts on the Polish brothers? Have you seen their films?
Oh. I don't think I have.
The film that Kenny and I are doing next week is called Twin Falls, Idaho, which is a film by the Polish brothers. They've done a handful of movies. I felt like maybe you would have seen like North Fork or The Astronaut Farmer. It feels like something that maybe a Karen Hahn might have seen.
Yeah, I'm looking at all of these titles and I've just missed all of these movies.
I think you would like Twin Falls, Idaho. It's okay. It's basically,
it's a good movie.
I think you'll really dig it. It's basically two Siamese twins that are attached at the chest, and their relationship with this. I don't know what would you call her, Kenny? I mean, was she a prostitute? I can't tell if she was or not.
She was.
It's got a very sort of, and you know, Kenny and I talk a fair amount about this in the episode, just about sort of, and I'm curious as to your thoughts on this, of just sort of people trying to do Lynchian things, mm-hmm. and why that is a mistake for most filmmakers to do.
Yeah.
I think that these guys actually pull it off, and their career kind of unfortunately doesn't take off in the way that maybe they would have liked. But do you have thoughts about people? Yeah, sorry. Go ahead.
Oh, I've seen one of their movies and it's 90 Minutes in Heaven.
Okay, I don't know what that is.
It's a Christian drama film that I watched a Christian podcast. To be clear, I'm not Christian. I've watched that movie by Michael Polish.
The Polish brothers got to eat too.
Career got away from them. What can I say?
It is worth watching for sure, because I think more than almost every other movie that you kind of describe or maybe damn with faint praise as Lynchian, mm-hmm. this movie is in a conversation with Lynch films.
Yes.
This movie plays with your expectations of what a Lynchian film might be, down to the title, right? Like title of this film feels
a nod to Twin Peaks, sure.
Nod to Twin Peaks. Yeah. It's interesting in that way. And mm-hmm. almost immediately you start to feel like, you're trying to do Lynch. And then pretty
kind
quickly,
of stops. Yeah,
it's
doing
clear
it.
He's
yeah.
not.
Yeah,
but he wants you to kind of have that expectation going in. I really loved it.
I would also, my question to you, Karen, is more about sort of what are your feelings about, not about David Lynch per se, but of just kind of filmmakers that try to do that.
A man who famously has never met a woman.
God damn it, Kenny. He's just trolling for Twitter people to yell at him again for a joke he made about David Lynch. Continue, Karen.
Okay, sure. I was like, okay. Well, I mean, I think it's sort of the same mistake that a lot of studios tend to make the most recent example I can think of is like when Everything Everywhere All at Once came out and was really successful, and a trade wrote like, this shows that people are eager for multiverse movies, and it's like, no, that's not really the root of like what makes this object so special, which I think is what happens when people say Lynchian a lot. They just mean I think it's weird, which is not what he's about, mm-hmm. not that simply anyway. So
yeah, no, I couldn't agree with you more. I do think that, I mean, and listen, as we all know, this town is superficial and tends to draw conclusions based on the mm-hmm. least challenging notions they can take from said piece of art. So it is common and unfortunate. And I do think that it's easy to paint Lynch with that brush of, oh, he's weird. Oh, it's weird. It's quote unquote quirky. It's whatever. Whereas I think that there's obviously so much more going on in his films. And I think there's so much more going on in Twin Falls, Idaho mm-hmm. than what I imagined when it was released in 99, of sort of, I imagine being painted with that brush as well, which is, you know, a bummer. But check out the movie. I believe it's streaming still on Pluto or IMDb TV or whatever it is now. But check out Twin Falls, Idaho. Karen, this was a pleasure. As always, we're
so
thankful.
Thank you so much for having me back on.
Oh my God. Thank you for taking the time. We're so glad that we were able to make it happen. And we honestly, as is always the case, we can't wait to have you back in the future.
Oh my gosh, me neither. Wait, can I do a plug?
Absolutely.
Of course. My book, Bong Joon-ho, Dissonant Cinema, is coming out in November, and you can pre-order it now or wait till then to buy it. But anyway,
it's available for pre-order as we speak.
Yep.
Is there can we see what it looks like? Is there a cover art?
Yeah, the cover is up. Yeah.
Okay.
It's pretty official now.
I need to check that out. cannot wait to read this. Cannot
Thank
wait to
you.
See it. For the nerds out there, buy Okja so that on Criterion, so that you can read Karen Hahn's beautiful essay about Okja that is inside the disc.
Thank you.
A beautifully weird, lovely movie, mm-hmm. With a beautifully written essay in front of it. Just get all the Karen Hahn you can, guys. buy her Super Yaki t-shirts.
Nice forward, David Lowery.
Yeah, we just confirmed Very that or cool. we just that is I guess it hasn't really been announced yet, but yeah, he
Amazon knows.
For us, which is very nice of him.
That is Amazon knows. I guess they've said it on Amazon, so
yeah, or I know they updated the cover. No, but
I mean,
he told
me first, but but I knew that I could. He said it's okay if I tell people,
so
yeah, forward by David Lowery. So at the least, go buy for his beautiful writing.
At the very least, you get a little bit of David Lowery. No, yeah. Buy the book, because I can only imagine what Karen Hahn waxing poetic about Bong Joon-ho for
I'm
an entire book.
Get it. I'm going to get it right now.
It's oh, thank
my,
you.
My wife's favorite director.
Also, if you think my writing sucks shit, there's a bunch of interviews at the back of the book with Bong's collaborators who are really cool and who everybody loves. So
we're very excited for your scripted writing. But as you know, you're the best in the game.
No,
you're
thank
the best
you.
In the game. So we're excited about the Bong book, but
The Bong book's going to be.
But I'm sure it'll be the best in this game too. All right.
Thank you so much, Karen. This is an absolute.
Thank you guys
pleasure.
So much.
All right, I'll talk
All
to you
right,
soon.
Good to see
Bye,
you.
Guys.
Bye.
Hey, folks. I'm Mark Maron from the WTF podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues. Your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.